Hello, you are listening to the episode 1 of Octahedron podcast, and today it is 20th of August, 8 o'clock p.m. Central European time. Is it the 20th of August?
No, it's the 22nd.
Okay, it is the 22nd of August, and we're here in the studio with Dirk.
Hello.
Yeah, and Florian.
Hello.
And today we're going to be talking about blockchains and legal stuff. Basically.
So maybe we should mention that we tried to record this like a month ago and it failed. So if we sound weird, it might be the reason that we think we talked already about it.
But yeah, but we'll
so try. It might be weird. But yeah, we try to talk about the same thing as with a failed recording.
So basically, maybe we were censored. That's like a conspiracy theory, right? We were
talking about my computer was censored. Yeah. Censoring us. Mm,
exactly. So, but some time passed after the DAO goxed, because I think last month we were talking a lot about that, because it was like really a good... it's like a Pavlov's dog in terms of like DAOs and legal stuff. But I was I was thinking maybe we spoke too much about it, and maybe this time we can talk about other stuff, such as just like, actually we didn't talk just about that. We spoke a little bit about like regulatory compliance and EU and stuff like that. And maybe this time I also wanted to actually talk about the crowd sales. And last time I was a little bit afraid of talking about it because it's like a sensitive topic. But this time I'm more, I have more courage. So before I start overtaking this podcast totally, I was wondering, Florian, did you hear anything like amazing in legal world and the world of blockchains for the past month or so?
Something amazing.
Something interesting or terrible.
So was anybody sued over the DAO?
Yeah, that's a good question.
not to my knowledge.
Okay, not yet.
No, not yet. Yeah, and I mean, judging by what has been published by the people responsible for this whole mess, at least it is believed that by doing the hard fork, the danger of scrutiny by regulators or lawyers and judges has been averted. I don't think that is 100% guaranteed for sure.
So the SEC now was shut up again because they were threatening to look into this, right?
I'm pretty sure that the DAO and Ethereum in general is on the watch list of the global financial authorities. At least that's what people are saying, and I was recently in a podium discussion together with Christoph Jentsch, the original author of the smart contract behind the DAO, and
Was that recorded? That
talk? Yes, you can find it on YouTube.
Okay.
So we got our first link.
So he said that by doing the hard fork, they could, I don't know, sue the financial authorities that were trying to look or threatening to look at it. Though I think that is pretty naive.
Yeah, in the long idea. Run, they will look at it, right? I mean,
yeah, for sure. Yeah, and they should, because as long as it's taking place in this gray area between legality and illegality, it will stop a lot of people interested in doing something like a crowd sale, for example, from actually doing it, because they would rather not end up in jail or risk some kind of penalty.
So how do we find this interview or this recording?
Sure, I can send you a link.
Okay, thank you. I had a thought and now it's lost. Does anyone of you two know what exactly happened with this hard fork? I mean, what exactly was done with the hard fork? The funds the Ether went back to the original investors, or what happened with the hard fork?
As far as I understand it, the hard forked chain replaced the original DAO contract with a refund contract that gives you back your money,
the Ether,
in Ether.
So nobody,
when you send DAO tokens there.
Ah, so you have to send your tokens there. So
exactly,
people could still keep their. But
yeah, sure. I mean,
but the owners of the tokens were those at the beginning of the contract, or how does that work? Who gets back?
Oh no, you just, I mean, if you hold tokens, then you have a balance in the DAO contract, right?
Yeah.
And those balances were preserved. So whoever was the current owner of a number of tokens before the drain started, now is again the owner.
Okay.
And
and the value of the tokens is still the same.
That's the thing, yeah. So I mean, the value. So the refund contract gives you back your tokens on a 1 to 100 exchange cores, the original exchange cores.
Yeah.
However, the rate. I mean, the exchange rate. However, in the crowd sale of the DAO, the value of the tokens increased on a daily rate. It was like this viral sell. And the extra money that has been gained with this increasing price of the tokens has been put into a separate contract, which is called the extra balance contract, which is now being administered by the curators of the DAO. And they will basically manually send back this extra balance to the people who originally paid it.
Who paid more.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah. So it's basically, it's a little bit like a post-crowd sale thing. When you buy your stuff on a crowd sale, then you have like an arbitrary JSON file or whatever you have to upload, and you have to go through all these procedures to like get actual Ether, I think. But that was the crowd sale. So it's almost... And then there are a lot of issues with it, and people lose their wallets, and or something doesn't happen. But eventually, manually, with a lot of support of the tech team, somehow all this stuff gets reimbursed. That's how I imagine it.
Yeah, kind of like that. I mean, there's a lot of higher amount of automation in this than compared to, for example, the initial Ethereum crowd sale, because you don't need to keep any files off-chain, except, of course... No, actually, you don't. Yeah, of course, you shouldn't lose the private keys to your account that holds the DAO tokens, obviously. But
yeah, then you're screwed. But then,
yeah, then you're screwed. But besides that, you don't need to keep some kind of off-chain thing or anything. It's basically all on the blockchain. So it is, it is pretty comfortable in that regard, I guess.
Okay. So something. Something else has happened, I think, again with the DAO, and we just can't shut up about it, is I think people were raving about why did Ethereum developers moved these tokens from that they drained from the old chain, the Ethereum Classic, and these tokens have been moved and people are upset about it. This Ethereum Foundation, aka Robin Hood team, as CoinTimes wrote, I don't know if it's of any interest to us, but yeah.
Well, it's definitely interesting because this group of white hat hackers that originally drained the rest of the DAO after the attacker stopped his attack after having been made public, this original group was obviously not, you know, a very formal organization of people, but it was more like, I guess, some kind of chat room where some people gathered and took action. And then the hard fork happened, and whatever they did on the chain that is now the new Ethereum chain has been reverted, so it doesn't matter. But on the Ethereum Classic chain, which no one expected to live on, the white hat hackers still own this... this currency. And
and also the attacker.
Of course, also the attacker. And now suddenly it's relevant who is this white hat hacker group, because the ETC does have some economic value. There is a market where it can be sold.
Yeah.
So obviously people are like, well, that is real money and I want a share of it. So it's definitely interesting if there is some kind of potential legal remedy if the white hat hacker group should decide to just dump all the ETC and just run away with the money. Or what I've read was also the suggestion that they dump the ETC, buy Ether with it, and then give back that Ether to the original investors of the DAO, which, I mean, is definitely...
Which is a bit wild.
It's very wild. Because
yeah, they should give back ETC, right?
For sure. I mean, if
not ETH.
I think that is really a strong... it has a strong kind of bias, political bias, with this whole debate between Ethereum Classic and and the new Ethereum chain. I don't think they should do this. I mean, they try...
They tried
to stay as neutral as possible, like the Mist wallet, for example, offering to connect to either the old chain or the new chain. So this kind of neutrality, I think, is a good path to go down for the foundation, at least. And I think also the White Hat Hacker Group, who seems to have at least close ties to people within the foundation and so on. So
you say they should not transfer this to ETH, but they should give it back as ETC, or also don't do that? They should just ignore the ETC branch.
What does my judgment... I'm not the one to judge their actions, right? And legally speaking, it's very tough to say who owns what in this case.
And you shouldn't give legal advice anyway.
I don't give legal advice here, but
what is your personal opinion? I mean,
my personal opinion is that, you know, I think the white hats should just, I don't know. I think they should leave it on the ETC chain, and yeah, they should try to give it back to
SETC.
Yeah.
To find an algorithm that is fair to
refund people in ETC as well. Then people get free money, right? Because now...
No.
Yeah, but they would have gotten it anyways. I mean,
yes, I mean, I also got free money.
Yeah,
yeah, everyone got free money.
I just wonder who is buying this.
Yeah.
I mean, it still has a price, right? Yeah. There's still people buying ETC. I mean...
I mean, that's so interesting about this whole cryptocurrency space. It's, although it's decentralized in some form, supposedly, it's the whole media is kind of controlled by different interest groups, right? I mean, everybody says that our Bitcoin is controlled by...
the core developers or China or...
Yeah, someone.
Or the
and then our BTC is... I know, controlled by that. Our Ethereum is controlled by them. Our Ethereum Classic. So it's like it's really tough to kind of get an objective picture of the situation, and especially in the case of how realistic is it that Ethereum Classic will exist in the future? I mean, if you listen to guys like this Charles Hoskins, or what is this kind of original Ethereum co-founder who then left Ethereum due to some conflict of interest with the other people. Like, I think he wanted to get venture capital to fund Ethereum originally, but then people decided to do crowd sale, so he left. I think that's the story I've read.
And this guy is now on ETC.
No, he's in Ethereum Classic and says... Okay. Basically, so he's someone who understands the technology, I think, pretty deeply, which is actually rather rare. I think most people on having something to do with Ethereum don't understand the technology deeply enough to, you know, make improvements to the software running this whole system. And
well, there is the foundation with several teams of...
Exactly, there is the foundation, but
sure.
But outside the foundation, there aren't too
many
people.
Maybe the guys of Aeris Industries, they might
possibly
also be able.
For sure. I mean, they do work in the space. So anyway, so he's I think a strong candidate who can really move the needle to some extent, and he's supposedly totally behind Ethereum Classic. Now there are other people saying, well, the supporters of Ethereum Classic are just trying to lower the value of Ethereum in order to buy in more cheaply. So I don't know. I don't know. It's confusing, but I think.
It's really, to me, it's really fascinating that we now have two currencies competing on the same network of nodes.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. It's really interesting times.
I think it's beautiful as well.
It's really interesting. And I also think ETC can't have a future, but on the other hand, it's still there.
Kicking,
it's still there. It's still traded. It still has a value, although it's 10 times lower than the ETH value, or even more. I'm not sure. I didn't check recently. But it's when I heard that there is ETC now, I thought, how is it possible to have two currencies on the same
network?
It
really also blew my mind as well,
So there must be nodes that run the old software, and there are nodes that run the fork software. And there are miners that mine on the old with the old rules, and there are miners, of course, that mine with the new rules. And now there are blocks produced every 15 seconds that are on different chains. So there are two competing chains in this network. And one is accepted by one set of nodes, and one is accepted by another set of nodes. So ETC will stop only to exist if the exchanges cannot reach any nodes anymore that accept this ETC rule set, or when. So what's the point when ETC will cease to exist?
Yeah, there are multiple stakeholders that keep the system running. One, of course, is the miners. I mean, you need people to put in proof of work in order to create some kind of security characteristics. Otherwise, it's just going to be hacked easily.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, you don't necessarily need it, but definitely it helps if you have an exchange bringing liquidity into this.
Yeah, and bringing a price so that people have the feeling.
Yeah, if I mean, that's why a lot of people were angry at Poloniex, because they were the first exchange.
Oh, they were the first?
Yeah, list Ethereum Classic.
Mm-hmm.
And
who was angry?
You know, the people that wanted to see the old chain
die. Yeah. Okay.
Essentially, the people responsible for the hard fork, obviously.
Yeah, but it was funny because everyone had this feeling, and now the old chain gonna die that's actually a good sign of that everything on the media can create an illusion, because maybe because I follow people who support Ethereum, non-classic. the forked Ethereum, and anyway, I follow them, and it seemed like everyone is up for it, and then this change is gonna die, and then some people I spoke to, like one-on-one, they're like, no, and we actually did the first episode, we didn't even know what to think because it was crazy. So anyway, and then all of a sudden the forking happens, and the chain just persists, and I joined Ethereum Classic Slack channel, actually.
Ooh.
So I was also thinking, should I join it with my real name? Because what if people...
Maybe you get a mark on your forehead.
Yes, exactly. But I joined it anyway because I was interested if there are any like tech talk in there, or whether just a bunch of speculators.
Yeah.
And I didn't spend that much time to be able to tell.
Apropos, I mean, it is true that the value is much lower than the value of ETH on Poloniex, but also the mining is much cheaper, right? So, and in the beginning, when they split up, I heard that it might even be lucrative to mine on ETC because it's so much easier to mine there.
So it's like, maybe it will become like a Litecoin, Ethereum Lite.
Yeah, that's
a classic.
An interesting point that Levin, who was also part of that discussion I was mentioning, brought up during the discussion. And I think it's correct when he says that forking a blockchain is extremely complex because of the game theoretical incentives that are created, which is what happened in the case of the Ethereum fork, because it was suddenly so much more... after Poloniex introduced the listing of this coin, it was suddenly much more valuable for miners to join the ETC chain than to stay on the new Ethereum chain. And obviously, they switched over and mined Ethereum Classic. And
some of them
yeah,
not the majority, or I don't know,
no, not the majority, but definitely a significant number.
Okay.
And it makes sense, because I mean the blockchain protocol is, I mean, it's modeled on the assumption that agents in the network behave rationally from this economic perspective, and that is what they did. But yeah, so it is very complex to fork a chain, and I think the Bitcoiners are definitely looking closely at how Ethereum handles this, because I mean they have to fork too at some point, and it seems that it's going to be a very contentious fork if one should happen. There will definitely be
and
probably two chains afterwards if they fork.
I didn't pay close attention to this, but were the ETC supporters also accused of helping the attacker of the DAO? Probably, right? There must be someone saying these are just thieves that want.
Yeah.
And by the way, what happened to the DAO funds on the ETC chain? Did they move?
Yeah, we were just discussing it. That actually, sorry, maybe we weren't clear about it. They were moved, and someone was really upset about it because the white hackers, white hacker group who drained the DAO, the dark DAO or something.
Yeah,
they tried to move them via exchanges, and they didn't make an announcement.
No, I mean the white hat or the. Yeah, white hat hackers, they moved the funds after the DAO was drained by a third. They moved the two-thirds that were in there somewhere else pay them back later. What happened to the first third that was drained?
Yes, yeah, so the first, as far as I understand, the first third is still locked. Second of September.
Ooh, so it is.
That's what I read. 2nd of September is the day where the attacker can finally move them, outside of this whole child contract, DAO system into a proper wallet and then potentially to an exchange.
That's very funny, because there is ESMA, European Securities and Markets Authority, who released the discussion paper, whatever it means, in June 2016, and they want, I mean, everyone maybe in the crypto space understands why the securities authority is like damn important, because they're going to come up with regulations which will regulate crowd sales.
Mm-hmm.
So on the 2nd of September, ESMA will consider all the comments received by that day.
Mm-hmm.
So now they're collecting all the comments.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, this must be magic, or they know about this stuff, because if the tokens from the dark DAO, they can be moved on the 2nd of September. That's why ESMA going to go through all the comments and actually make like some official statements, whatever.
I'm not sure that's really related.
I know, but it just crossed my mind. It's actually an interesting paper. It's actually called the Distributed Ledger Technology Applied to Securities Markets by this European Securities and Markets Authority.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to post the link.
So where would I look if I wanted to find out how much this ETC is worth that is in the dark DAO? Is it millions? Okay, let me quickly check the price on Poloniex. Anyway, okay, we didn't talk about the stuff we talked last time far. We were a bit
it's
distracted.
It's a new podcast. That's good.
Yeah, I think we shouldn't even maybe call it legal stuff, because we're talking a little bit about that, but more an update about the DAO. It's a dangerous topic. Once you start talking about it, it never goes away.
It is so interesting. I really... I'm really happy that I have no stakes in there.
Okay.
Yeah, you should be.
Although I have some ether, and yeah, but the ether price is stable, basically.
Yeah, but what's interesting, I think, about this DAO, back to the legal stuff, is like the first. I remember when, like, in the middle of the DAO crowd sale, if I may call it crowd sale, whatever it was, I met with a friend of mine in a cafe, and he was like, "Oh my God, look at this account! Look how much money did this account raise?" And I was like, "Shit, this is dangerous, because if something bad happens to it, then the regulator's going to look into it." Because just like a month before that, I was talking to a lot of people floating around this regulatory space, and I was afraid that if something happens which is like dodgy with consumer protection and whatever, that's going to result in like really harsh regulations. And he was really positive. He said, "But look, if someone actually raised money through the DAO and really cool startups are going to spin off and raise money this way, then the regulator is going to look into it and say, well, actually, crowd sales are not always scam. So it's going to be really good." But unfortunately, like, I really want to believe that it's not going to completely put off all the regulators against like crowd sales.
Mm. Now that you say this, I mean, what legitimate company would use such a way to do a crowd sale and not the regular way
to do a crowdfund?
Yeah, because it's easier this way.
Because it allows you to actually create something that you like. If I receive a perk, like as a contributor to like a what it's called Indiegogo,
mm-hmm.
First of all, Indiegogo takes like a huge percentage. So if you're talking, if you compare it to like crowdfunding,
okay, so it's less overhead or less financial
less overheads,
loss.
And then you can automatically you can define the rules by which this token people can use, because in like decentralizedly, technically that's I mean not necessarily, but. Yeah, it's hard to tell because there are so many different flavors of crowd sales, I think. Because if I were omnipotent, and I'm not educated as a legal person, so I don't have to make a disclaimer about legal advice, but if I were God or whatever, actually someone says God stands for Global Online Database, right? anyway, where was I? Yeah.
So if you were omnipotent.
If I were omnipotent, I would distinguish crowd sales not by looking at some sort of securities law, but trying to look into what people are actually building. Because, for instance, I know it's impossible, but if people building something which might be a service, then okay. But if people just pretend they're building something,
okay. If they are doing obvious scams,
yeah.
That I would also agree is a problem.
Because I don't see a huge distinction or anyone talking yet, but maybe I'm not part of right circles, people distinguishing between like real scams and crowd sales. And I'm really don't want to see these things mixed. Because, for instance, I see people, like legitimate people building software, for instance, talking about crowd sales, talking, oh, should we go for it? Or maybe we're going to get all into jail and stuff like that.
Mm.
And at the same time, recently I went to this Bitcoin meetup, girls Bitcoin meetup, and it never happened to me before in Bitcoin meetups, but that was the first girl Bitcoin meetup I attended.
I know what you're going to say now.
Yeah.
And I don't.
Non-coin or something.
Yeah, and there was there was someone present there saying, oh, like, you can become a member of some mining pool and give us 400 euros and we're going to mine shitcoin for you. And I'm just like...
Yeah.
Was he really saying shitcoin?
Well, yeah, almost. And the crazy thing is, like, this, no one in the EU is talking about this kind of stuff because they can't. Like, loads of non-tech people, if they look into it, they're like, it's the same stuff. One is called OneCoin, another one is called something else coin, and one is some awesome token which actually built on protocols and algorithms that people spend huge amount of money and time which, well, time, money. I wanted to say time, actually, but Freudian slip. And which probably will be useful for other stuff, like, I don't know.
So what you're saying is to make this mass compatible, we need regulations.
No, but
to prevent people from being scammed.
I mean, I'm just...
I mean, I totally...
I'm not saying that we need regulations, but I'm just afraid that in the eyes of, like, normal people, these two things don't make... Like, they don't look different.
Exactly. Yeah. That's so the thing. They're indistinguishable from someone who isn't so involved in this whole scene that, you know, okay,
yeah,
this
that's
is
what I mean by
someone
mass.
With a, you know...
But it's very easy to distinguish, for instance. Like, for instance, if you see, okay, this shit was pre-mined or it's not mined at all...
But Ethereum was pre-mined too.
Yeah, and yeah, you would need to know... I mean, yeah.
Ether wasn't pre-mined, was it?
Ether was?
No.
No, but it was pre-sold.
It was pre-sold, yeah. That's
yeah.
True.
It's a pre-mine.
Pre-mine is when you run your test chain without going public.
Yeah, okay, yeah, but it's even worse if it's pre-allocated. I mean, you don't even have
true.
To run a mining
yeah,
rig.
There is not even a chain, yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the thing. And, I mean, one of the measures that a regulator usually takes in such a case is to give the organization making such a crowd sale an information mandate, meaning they have to put out a certain specified number and amount of information of what they are planning to do, how the investment is going to work, what kind of rights and obligations you enter into by investing into this asset, what all kinds of different informations you have to put out in order to do this legally. And that is exactly to prevent or to enable consumers who are not, you know, hanging out in all the Slack channels all the time and
yeah,
on Reddit, basically to enable them to make an informed decision.
Yeah,
and
I heard also in Jamaica this like scam coins are really big and people just don't understand what this technology is about, so yeah. It's like a new thing.
Yeah, I wonder if regulators would even help in this case. I mean...
Well, usually they
wonder,
don't help that much, but maybe a little bit. Sorry.
Yeah, so how is it possible to have a future that that everybody can participate? Or will that never happen? Will we never have crowd sales on...
No, so I think something that I wanted to add to the discussion is that the crowd sales in form of app coins or what they're called, I think they are really a new kind of crowd investment model. And they're interesting to fund, for example, protocol development, right? Or more generally, the funding of public goods. They're really good at that. Like in the case of Ethereum, they developed really valuable open source software, and they were funded through this crowd sale mechanism. So I think this is a very positive example of what you can do. And now, of course, there are lots of other projects that try to do something similar. And now, because Ethereum exists and it's this general purpose platform, many people are doing crowd sales now based on Ethereum. They don't launch a whole protocol.
Them.
Yeah, it's much easier. And I mean, that is also the promise of Ethereum, to facilitate exactly. It's so general the technology that you can then launch your crowd sale on the blockchain. And so I think this is a very attractive and interesting model that should definitely be encouraged for certain situations. But then again, there need to be clear rules on what the requirements are to do something like this legally. And right now there's really this divide between, and I would say most lawyers do believe that there is, it touches upon securities regulation. And So I really hope that we see clarification from regulators in that regard. I think it would help the ecosystem for sure.
I wonder what they can do to prevent people from investing in scams.
That's, you can never prevent that. It's just,
you could just warn. You could just put out a warning, don't buy shitcoin.
Yeah, or we think, I don't know. To me, it didn't take that much time to figure out what is what can be scam and what can't be, but then you have to really wrap your head around it, right? Someone publishes code, or you see, actually, sometimes I could think, okay, if I see like a bunch of engineers, and it's like, it's hard to tell.
Well, I couldn't tell if Ethereum 2 years ago, I couldn't tell if it's
I couldn't.
It's a scam.
That's why I turned up.
I just thought that's really ambitious, what you are trying. I'm not ready to invest in this.
I think it was, I thought it was a scam because, like, I don't know, it was just like too shiny and
it sounded too good to be possible.
Yeah, and also, like, when you spend a lot of time in like talking about crypto, like about these coins to other people, the first reaction is like, oh, this is a scam. As I think I mentioned it before, there is this, what I noticed, there is this rite of passage, or there was this rite of passage with like old school altcoins. Not with this new app coins, you call them?
Those are the tokens?
Yeah. Tokens.
Token schemes.
With altcoins, there was this tradition, I think, on all the forums, if there is like a new coin, everyone gonna like, that's a scam, and you're gonna prove to us why it isn't. So it's like the opposite of the benefit of a doubt, right?
Mm. Yeah.
And I think I was feeling the same way about Ethereum, and then I turned up at the conference, and then was hanging out with these people, and I kind of...
Before they had any code, right?
They were writing it, but by then they were presenting stuff.
Okay.
And actually, some elements of it, sometimes I lose my faith and I think, I don't know, will Swarm ever be developed or
I also had doubts that they could pull it off within a reasonable amount of time, but that was when I saw they were developing it. Then I thought, okay, this will take longer than you anticipate. And it did. But in the end, they still released last August with the mainnet. And but at that point, or just before that, I didn't think it was a scam. I thought maybe they cannot pull it off.
Like too ambitious.
Yeah, too ambitious maybe. Or maybe they have to scale down. And I think they did scale down, and also they made compromise. So I heard about this peer-to-peer protocol that they are using now. Actually, the developer wanted to have it much better. We talked about this, right, last time?
Yeah, I think what I heard, loads of stuff could be improved.
But they had to release it, and so they did. And actually, Ethereum, the release went quite well. Actually, surprisingly well. There could have been more
but
bugs.
It's interesting because so if someone thought it would be a scam, I mean, if let's say I want to, like, I'm really malicious and I want to do a crowd sale and I never want to build anything.
Yeah.
So I do a flashy website, I give people free swag or whatever. I push it. And then another scenario is like, I really want to do...
Actually, that would be suspicious to give out free swag for...
Weird thing is, like... Like every time I see free stuff, I remember there was this strange bank. It's not a bank; it's a startup, and they were distributing these prepaid cards with like Bitcoin on them, and you're supposed to like register them. And I don't think that was a scam, but it's just something
it
that
felt like.
It felt like it.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is not a good promotion for your service, even if you have a lot of Bitcoins. Like, just don't. Don't do this kind of stuff because it's just too. It just looks too bad. Yeah. Something I wanted to say, I forgot. Yeah, and the second scenario is when you're actually really ambitious and you want to build software and you sold your token, but then it turns out that maybe you don't have enough operational capacity and developers are not like ready to build that, because a lot of this stuff actually needs totally new protocols. Like, for instance, like, well, proof of stake or... all these off-chain transactions and whatever.
Yeah, and it's hard to come up with a working solution, and maybe you're just not able to do it.
Let's just say you shouldn't be able, or you shouldn't raise money for something of which you do not know if you're actually capable of producing it. I mean, it's the same with Kickstarter, right? I mean, we've seen it there many times, how people have a flashy video, but they never achieve to release the product because they... had no experience with building hardware in China or the typical stuff.
Yeah, I think it's okay to fail. I mean, if you know in advance that you will not be able to do it, then of course you shouldn't do it.
Sure.
But if you just don't
but you
know
shouldn't
if
get
you're
any
really
money, if you're like, I mean, if I'm making a crowd sale for a new kind of protocol,
yeah, It should be locked until you deliver milestones.
I should have to provide the information legally required to my potential investors of how I'm intending to create this said application or protocol, who my team is, how they are capable of achieving this. And so, I mean, if I don't have the stuff figured out when I'm raising money, then it's just
too risky.
I would disagree.
Not too risky. It's just
irresponsible.
It's a scam.
It's weird.
In that moment, it becomes a scam to me because, of course, you can have the best intentions of creating whatever. But I mean, if you don't have the network of people to create it, then you're not capable of doing it.
It's funny. I would disagree because, which is rare, I think. I would rarely disagree with you. But it makes me think of like funding, for instance.
VC funding. They also risk.
They risk, and that's where innovation happens. But what it made me think of mainly is like, for instance, if you want to apply for European funding, you have to really prove your operational capacity and blah, 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 and have like universities on the application. And in the end, half of them are scams because nothing ever gets built. And I mean, okay, there are some projects, and I'm not gonna like, I'm not really gonna shit on it on the podcast because, okay, but I don't think that. Well, I can be pretty honest. Is like some software they build is shit, not because it's a bad software or bad people, is because maybe it's a bit old school and no one is using it, and then they give out more money for people to use this software in other projects. So sometimes they push protocols, and then there is this Concord effect when EU, let's say, invested a lot of money into, like, I don't know, linked data, and maybe linked data is awesome, I don't know, but they will keep continuing pushing, like, throwing money into it because they already did and it has to succeed. So
yeah,
it's like too big to fail.
That's public funding because it's kind of disconnected from market dynamics, right?
But
yeah, but
that's a general problem. How can public institutions fund projects?
I have a more narrow definition of a scam. So for me, a scam is the malicious intent is necessary. Otherwise, it's not a scam. Otherwise, it might be a failure. So I would, in that regard, I would disagree. I mean, I would say scam is more narrowly defined as...
Well, there is negligence and...
Okay. Yeah, I'm not a lawyer, so I can say that.
No, I'm... no, by negligence, I mean, you're violating some fundamental duties.
Yeah, okay.
That you just have to be aware of.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're just scamming people, even if you don't want to, right?
Okay, so there is this scam is not as narrowly defined as I make it.
No, I mean, scam isn't a legal term either, so don't worry about it.
Okay.
No, what I just mean is there are people that that are running pump and dump schemes, how it's called in the crypto scene.
Yeah.
And then there are people that, you know, heard about this AppCoin thing, how they can fund their awesome idea that they had for years. And now, well, if they're clever enough, they are able to kind of get the technology in place to run such a scheme.
Mm-hmm.
But they would never be able to build the actual technology they want to build with this money.
Yeah.
So that can be definitely negligent, I think.
Yeah, I agree.
Mm.
So what's next?
check the pad.
Yeah, what's next? One of the people I hear about, like, please don't go into crowd sales is Preston, and I respect him a lot because he's a lawyer and he understands this technology. Is the Ares guy, one of the Ares guys, and he's like really, really.
What do you mean when he says, or what does he mean when he says, don't go into crowd sales?
He says it just basically illegal stuff with securities. So
he says nobody should do that.
He doesn't call it legal advice, but he says, well, I wouldn't do that, and Ares never done it.
Okay.
Because
he says that you shouldn't connect blockchains and finance in the sense that you're running a coin on a blockchain. I think generally he wants to use blockchains
for
everything else they're capable of doing, like creating transparency and auditability and all that stuff, automation, smart contracts. But you shouldn't try to run decentralized currency, essentially.
Yeah.
On blockchain, it's too. I don't know. It's not capable to go mainstream. Essentially,
sounds like reasonable advice.
Yeah, it's reasonable advice. But I came across a blog post of another reasonable person, maybe not a lawyer. And I'm going to post it in links as well. It's called On Protocol Tokens and Securities Law, which is actually not as depressing as you usually hear from like lawyers. That and I think, well, and I liked reading it because I thought, well, it's such a powerful tool to actually lift your ideas off the ground. For instance, crowdfunding is quite powerful. You can actually do amazing shit with it. But it's also centralized, and I did one crowd. I took a part in one crowdfunding campaign, which wasn't decentralized, which was done through what it's called,
Indiegogo,
and Indiegogo was like charging enormous amounts of money. Whatever, it's not so fun. So it's a great tool. So I was thinking, even if it will be like maybe some regulation is going to be super harsh in the beginning, at some point there will be some turning, which will. People will find a way to do this crowd sales if they really want to. Not as scams, but like as to pursue their ideas, I think.
So how would I, as in someone who's interested in funding a project, how would I know that this is not a scam? With Indiegogo, I can assume that they did some checks.
I don't think so.
The DAO had the curators for that, right? I mean...
Yeah, that would look at the proposals and
exactly. They deny make sure proposals. That's a real company or that's a trustworthy group of people asking for that amount of money and so on, like some basic sanity checks.
Yeah,
but I think it's also it's weird. You can't scale trust, and like when you try to scale trust via trustlessness, there are things like, for instance, like what it's called green light on Steam, right? When you can crowdfund little games like indie games, and you throw some like €5 or like $5 or whatever into the system, and you fund some games, and sometimes they post like amazing graphics, and actually it's a graphic designer who made all the graphics, but he can't make a game, and the graphics are amazing, and you think, okay, these dudes, they're really making a cool game, and if you're into graphics, then you might actually contribute, and it's just someone. Wanting to maybe it's someone who has hopes to raise some money and then talk to his developer friends and say, let's do a game. But actually, most of these games never get finished.
But then he can pay them, right? When he has the funds during the crowd sale or crowdfunding, well, then he might be able to pay developers.
Yeah, but he will never return this money back to
Oh, that's not what this is about. This is about getting the game in the end.
Yes, but what if this person, like, no one likes him and he stinks and he's a great graphic designer, but no one wants to do a game with him?
Yeah, okay. Well, then he should be he should be honest and give it back, right?
Yeah, but no one ever does. They just spend it.
So maybe what I was thinking is, if it's only €5, then maybe it's okay. I put €5 into like 10 games, for example, and then one game comes out of it, and then I paid €50 for a game. That's fine.
What you get in return is a game. You never become a stakeholder in this game.
Okay.
With crowd sales, you can do so much more. You can make your token holders, like, you can give them special permissions to do certain stuff, like the DAO wanted to do. Like, you can give them votes, or you can give them, I don't know, something a bit more advanced than just sending them a mug and saying thank you. You know, like, that's... But I think there was a long discussion about, at least in Europe, I think, what we're going to do with crowdfunding. Is it like, do we tax it? Is it like even legal? I don't know. I remember this Kickstarter and so on. And still, because no matter how this tool is... Maybe not, maybe a bit primitive, still, it's a great tool and people using it. So you can't, like, totally out-regulate it.
Well, they might even use it if it's out-regulated. You can then only warn, like, you warn of certain drugs. Don't buy the pills with the whatever on it, because like a drug check, you can have a DAO check.
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, blockchains cannot be regulated, right? I mean, they're peer-to-peer. and so on. Just like BitTorrent, although it's forbidden in Germany to share, to download and to upload copyrighted files that you don't have the copyright to through BitTorrent, people still do it. Although then again, in Germany, you have those watchdogs on the network tracing your IP and so on.
Yeah, but it's different with Ethereum and Bitcoin.
Exactly. So that's something you can't outlaw. So, I mean, crypto token sales can exist even if regulators will forbid it.
Yeah, I think regulators and whatever authority has to spend more time advising people on and researching like what is a scam and what isn't.
Yeah, that would be nice, like Stiftung Warentest for...
Yeah, exactly, like rating agencies in some form that give a rating of, okay, risk is such and such or something like that.
Then I can get paid by just telling people what is a scam and what isn't. And that's I would love that.
What if you're wrong?
Well, that's a risk. You have to.
That's why you have insurance.
You have to take a risk, yeah. Yeah. Something else I wanted to talk about, but I have no idea how long we spoke for.
I can tell you. Well, almost an hour. Well, yeah.
Okay, so actually I wanted to say that there is a bunch of other podcasts I listen to, and I decided not to repeat myself. There is a lot of stuff in, it's like Podcast Watch. There was a lot of stuff that I found interesting on Epicenter Bitcoin about EU regulations. And it's like it's almost pointless to repeat all this stuff because people can just like go and listen to it. But the first 20 minutes is about Brexit for some reason, so you can skip it if you're sick of it. But the rest of it is really is actually quite interesting. There is some interesting stuff in there.
So we'll put this into the show notes.
Yeah, and another one. I don't know if you don't mind me quoting. Florian also did a podcast, but I don't know when it was. I just found it recently.
Yeah.
Was it
beginning of this year or something?
With Brian?
Or like March or April, maybe?
Epicenter?
Yeah, also with Epicenter. Cool. And there is a lot of like really sophisticated stuff in there, such as definition of smart contracts and what was it again? Anyway, it's a cool thing. I try to listen to it just so I don't create like repetitive content.
I should probably also listen. So, yeah, please put it in there.
Yeah, I'll put it in there. I don't mind like referencing any competitors, podcast competitors, if it's a good content, but it's not really competition.
I think we have different target groups.
Yeah, something else I wanted to do. I wanted to do something extremely risky this morning, but now it's like evening and I'm doubting if and basically this risky stuff is like make predictions. I don't know if...
Ah, yeah, you told me you want to make predictions.
Yeah.
So what are we going to predict?
I don't know how, maybe they're not like very... maybe they're super like obvious predictions, but I came up with four predictions.
Actually, when we're talking about predictions, something I'm very proud of, I even made a tweet out of it, is I predicted the DAO fork over a year ago. That was pretty cool. Yes.
What?
Do you have a reference for that?
Yeah, in in an article I wrote.
That's crazy.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I only realized it 2 weeks after the DAO fork that I actually realized that this would happen a year ago.
That's pretty powerful.
So could you talk about
I'm
going to
give you the link.
What did you predict? That there would be a smart contract in the future that would be exploited?
Yeah, so my idea was that the difference between Bitcoin and Ethereum with regards to the risk of forking is that in Ethereum it's much more likely than to happen in Bitcoin because... Yeah. Blockchains have the system of dividing the meaning of data and the processing of the data. Like miners process transactions regardless of the semantics or the meaning, the content of those transactions, right? That is like the idea of a blockchain. You have this crypto economy that is running this computer, this virtual computer, verifying transactions, calculating stuff, and so on. And the what this stuff really means is only relevant to the people using the system, but not to the miners providing those basic services to the network. Now, if you have a general purpose crypto economic computing platform such as Ethereum that can do stuff like crowd sales, like complex governance things, running a decentralized venture capital fund, what the DAO was, and all that stuff, or running a prediction market. There are a lot of transactions that can have really critical content, critical to the humans using that system. So there is a whole host of reasons why people would have an interest in one specific transaction not being published in the network or being modified. And if you compare it to Bitcoin, which is a pretty simple payment system, there's just a much higher risk in Ethereum. And that's pretty much exactly what happened in Ethereum. There was this DAO and this transaction making this re-entrancy attack and sucking out the Ether out of the DAO is pretty much exactly that. And to quote myself...
okay, I need to make some predictions so I can quote myself.
A general purpose crypto economic network may be able to account for consensus plurality, that is the coexistence of multiple groups with related but competing histories enshrined in their collectively maintained virtual state machines. In the event of a fork within an existing consensus group, market exchanges and merge mining may start to replace the preceding consensus-based integration of those people.
And I have to read that to understand it.
Yeah, I have to. I have to read it. Yeah, it's
it's pretty kind of. It's a bit of a mouthful. In a cloudy way, because
does it mean
I mean
that there are small things. No, I don't. I mean the difference between forking Bitcoin and or rolling back Bitcoin, so to change something in the past that is several blocks ago, you would need to roll back everything, and that is a much higher effort to do, as with Ethereum, where you don't have to roll back, you just define that. Oh, actually,
that's
you could do the same.
Supposedly not true. That
yeah,
is
you could
actually
do the same with Bitcoin, actually.
Yeah.
You just invalidate this one address and be done with it.
There was actually this discussion between Andreas Antonopoulos and Martin Köppelmann on exactly this. So there was this big discussion about the fork. And basically, there was the question, how difficult is it to do this kind of revert certain transaction
Bitcoin.
In Bitcoin vis-a-vis Ethereum. And Martin Köppelmann originally displayed it as in Bitcoin, it's just as easy to do as in Ethereum, where then Andreas said, no, you're making it much too easy. It's much harder in Bitcoin. And so I don't think they finally resolved it, and I'm not capable of making a final judgment here, but it seems that in both systems it's actually pretty complicated, and the only reason they could do it in Ethereum was because it was locked. The money was locked,
in this
child contract, and that is why it kind of didn't spread and poison the whole transactions that
blocks.
Followed after.
It was locked to one block
exactly.
Also.
That's the only reason.
And this is not possible in Bitcoin. Yeah. So the attacker in Bitcoin could have spread it before the fork, and then several thousand blocks might be affected, and that is really a problem.
Yeah.
Ah, interesting. So it's not generally easier in Ethereum. It was just, it was in this case, it was easier. So it's good to have these locks. I mean, actually, you can have this kind of lock also in Bitcoin. You can have a multisig transaction that would also lock the funds within basically one block.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, interesting.
Have anyone heard about this this contract on Ethereum, which is which looks like a normal contract, but actually, if you try to get the funds out of it, you pay more for gas because. I don't know if it's a joke, but I can research this.
I can imagine a contract being like that you have to put in more gas or more ether worth of gas. No,
because
gas
it's
worth
like
of ether.
It just pings your funds around so much within this contract. So and triggers so many transactions. So by the time that you actually get your money back, you you run out of gas.
You paid already for it.
Yeah, but I'm not sure if it's a joke, but...
I could imagine such a contract exists.
And it's I could imagine a lot of people with a sense of humor actually writing it, right?
Yeah, maybe if it doesn't exist yet, maybe someone will... Oh, that was your prediction?
No, that wasn't my prediction. Okay. So my predictions maybe are a bit boring. So one is like, I don't know, something which is obvious, but maybe it's not obvious for everyone. That's going to be second Cambrian explosion of crowd sales.
What explosion?
Cambrian explosion. I think it's a time in history when a lot of organisms just spread out. What was it like?
When we left the water?
Small shells or something. Like there was this amazing diversity. And I remember the diversity of altcoins a while ago. It was like a wave. And then there was like nothing and Bitcoin and Ethereum. And then like last year there was like a bunch of different crowd sales and whatever. I think like 2016 and 17, it's just going to be like the rest of this year and the next year going to be just crazy. People like
regarding crowd sales.
Regarding people from mainstream actually wanting to do a crowd sale and do some blockchain stuff.
Okay, I don't see this year, but
I think it's coming. I don't know. Maybe I'm making it up. But that's
I think
my
we
prediction.
Have to cool down from the DAO.
I'm not sure. In my experience, I've always underestimated how crazy this blockchain thing is getting. Like, okay. I was always very I still am very conservative about it, but I'm always surprised by how quickly this is
so
spreading.
You would agree that it might happen this year?
Yeah, I'm not like... I think it's really hard to make conservative predictions by now in blockchain.
It will happen because of the DAO Goxt. Because okay. People wanted like to happen and people saw all this like amazing like account and all this money coming in and thinking, oh, I actually have an idea. I can submit it now to the DAO and maybe people vote for me.
Ah, so now they know the need and now it's gone, so they need something else.
Yeah, so all these people who wanted to do a DAO proposal, a proposal to the DAO, then I was like, oh, screw that, we just do a crowd sale.
Okay.
But that's just, I don't know. It's just like they fed up. They wanted to be a part of it. Like I do a submission and I do this little code. I don't know. I provide some protocol on some platform, whatever. And I offer people some coins to support it and some tokens. And then the people of the DAO can put their funds, like vote for their funds to go into a certain project. And now all these people who started thinking about it, they actually fed up because they can't do it. So
yeah, I think we'll see that again. For sure.
And you would say it happens on Ethereum or on something else?
Yeah, of course.
Okay. I think it's going to be both. Like, people going to build their own stuff and people going to do it on Ethereum.
Yeah, I mean, look at... have you guys been following Steemit?
Steemit?
It's everywhere now.
Yeah, but I haven't been following it, so I don't know. I heard it's kind of scammy, but
yeah, me too. And it also has its own blockchain and its own coin.
Does it have to do with Steam, the service?
No.
Ah, okay.
It's not with an EA, but double E. Written.
Steam. Ah, yeah,
like
I have
Steam
seen
is like
this
Vapor.
Word. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's basically kind of a decentralized Reddit. At least that's how it looks. Right?
You can upload and download stuff. I've seen it.
I don't know. There was. Supposedly, it wasn't Prima. I don't know. The whole launch of the coin supposedly was scammy. At least that's what I read.
So what's our prediction regarding Steam?
Well, maybe if I were not recorded...
But that's the
I
weird thing. There were so many people before Steemit that tried to introduce the concept of micro payments for content on the web.
Yeah. It
like,
failed lots of times.
Like, yes. And now suddenly this random platform that supposedly... started out in the most scammiest of ways is like, I don't know, even Vitalik posted a Steemit link on Twitter. At this point, I was like,
What
is this? Like, is this really happening? I mean, I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know if Steemit is a scam, I have to say. I don't know. It's just what I've heard.
It's funny. It's like usually polite people never say something is a scam before they know. But actually, I can be like super impolite and I don't know any engineers working on it. I think it's a scam. Please contact me on Twitter and explain to me why it isn't. Because in the crypto world, there is no benefit of a doubt. It's like I would when I would turn up like at the Ethereum DevCon Zero, I would like totally over a beer ask someone who was there, like, actually I think it's a scam. Can you explain to me why it isn't? But I turned up and they actually saw all these people with like big circles under their eyes working their asses off, and I thought, well, they're actually working, so maybe I shouldn't troll them too much. But I'm not a troll, but I think trolling in this space is totally okay.
Yeah. At the time of DevCon Zero, I mean, it was still unclear whether they would keep any deadline.
Well, it was more clear that they weren't like a total hoax.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they had a proper office and they were all computer nerds, which I think is a very good.
And they already did meetups, right, where they explained stuff. Yeah. And anyway. No, another prediction?
No, I changed my mind.
I mean, if you are right.
Okay, I'll do one. It's like more blockchain-based centralized currencies, like Bank of England doing like blockchain pounds and
within 1 year, 2 years,
within 1 year, I think.
Okay,
yeah. Everything in 1 year, and it's almost going to become boring because like they're going to be blockchain euro and blockchain blockchain pound and blockchain yen and. And they will not be really, so everyone will stop raving about blockchains because you can do extremely boring stuff with blockchains. And then actually a prediction I made already, and I didn't get credit for it, is I remember there was Money 2020 like 2 years ago, and they started talking about blockchains. And I said, well, the year before the Money 2020, they spoke about Bitcoin. Everything was about Bitcoin. Then the next Money 2020 started talking about blockchains, and my prediction was, okay, the next one, the 2016, in Europe, they're going to be talking about blockchain-like data structures. And I was right. It's like Corda was announced by R3, and they said, oh,
so
actually...
Got ever more abstract. Like
they just, because basically they realize that for loads of things, they can't use blockchains, but they want blockchains. So they just take... It's like, I don't know, it's like yesterday I made like, I don't know, it's like everyone wants noodles and then you take rice and you say, well, it's a type of noodles, but it's, but it's short and it grows on a bush in like in water. And it's like...
It's easier accessible.
Yes.
Yeah, use so rice.
Yes.
It's also...
So it's like basically people coming out of the woodwork and saying, actually, distributed databases existed before and they're a bit like blockchains. So they also cool, so maybe we can use them as well. So make distributed databases great again, right? Via blockchain.
Via hashing stuff in it so it can't be modified.
Yeah, so
might
but
make sense. I don't
but
know.
It's funny. Some people I met, they're like, why are you so excited about blockchains? It's like slow, it's like it bloats. There are like other ways of making similar stuff. For instance, I have a bunch of acquaintances. They build this patchwork that I think they were presenting it here, where we are. They're also using Gossip Protocol for decentralized Twitter, and they don't give a shit about blockchains.
It's not necessary probably for their problem.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's so blockchains have done several things, and one is to resurface the value of having a shared database between multiple organizations and institutions. Not everyone keeping their own books, but sharing this task of keeping track of transactions and so on. It's super powerful. And that is something people needed to rediscover, and it seems that it needed the blockchain to cause this line of thinking. You can say that it's stupid, but I think in the end, it's a good thing that people are discovering this idea of organizing the I don't know, rebuilding basically many, many established institutions in society based on this idea of a shared ledger. And I mean, for some applications, a public blockchain just doesn't work. If you need some kind of privacy or, I don't know, if you need settlement finality, which is only ever probabilistic in a public blockchain that is based on proof of work. I mean, you can say, okay, this block is or this transaction is 10 blocks old, so it's unlikely that it's a whatever. So there are various reasons why you might want actually not a public blockchain or not a permissionless blockchain or whatever.
Or maybe not a blockchain at all.
Or maybe not a blockchain at all. But it's still, I think, cool that blockchains resurfaced the benefit of basically sharing the data.
Yeah, I agree.
And
one of the podcasts like I would like to do in the next coming month is the one about off-chain transactions and Raiden, and it's like...
You should get Heiko.
Yeah, exactly. So I spoke to him already, and I would really like to do that, because actually you don't have to put all the transactions into a blockchain, and sometimes you don't need to.
No, I mean, that's what we did at Satoshi Pay too, where we built an off-chain system that is still trustless for Bitcoin transactions. So it's called micropayment channels. And all you do is you escrow a certain amount of money on the blockchain and give it like a time lock. And then within this time lock, you can do transaction based on this escrowed money that are trustless but off-chain. And all you do is you settle all the transactions that you've done off-chain. In the very end, you settle them on the blockchain. Yeah.
But it doesn't make it faster. It just makes it cheaper.
It makes it possible.
Yeah, it makes it cheaper. Because you don't have to pay the blockchain's transaction cost for all the transactions you do. And it makes, I mean, all the off-chain transactions are instantaneous. They don't have, I mean, they are not connected to some kind of block time or whatever.
Yeah, even though we hold Octahedron, we probably should get, you worked on Satoshi Pay as well.
Yeah.
Maybe we should get like Meinhard and yourself again and talk about microtransactions.
Yeah, sure.
Where these payment channels are, okay, yeah, I have... talked in German.
Want to listen about that in German, then you can go and listen to it. Maybe we should wrap up, because
yes, let's do that.
I wanted to say, because I want to smoke, and then what if my parents ever listen to it?
They won't.
No, they won't. They definitely won't listen to till the end of it. Yeah, and we have a lot of content from the last attempt to record this similar podcast.
That's true. You posted a lot of links back then.
So, and that was all the stuff we discussed. So we ended up with like a good digest of all the legal stuff around blockchains, and we can just publish it.
So we keep the notes from the episode we never published and publish this episode.
Yeah, and I'm going to just brush up all the links and put it all together, and it's a nice selection of links.
Yeah,
perfect.
Okay.
Thanks, Florian.
Thanks for having me.
Okay.
Maybe we need a fourth microphone to have two guests in the future.
Okay. Bye, everyone.
Okay. Bye.